every few years, some physicist thinks that they've discovered God in their mathematical equations, which is, you know, somewhat understandable after you've stared at mathematical equations for hours upon hours. You discover all sorts of things. And what I hope is not to say that I've discovered anarchy in neuroscience, but I see some sort of general principles which relate subjects which most people would think are probably not that related. I've discovered God. You know, he's in my equations. You just want to look at them the right way. And this happens every few years and will no doubt happen for quite a few more decades. It may seem like I'm attempting to make that claim. I've discovered anarchy in neurons, but it's not really quite that simple. Basically, I think, I mean, my take on anarchism is that anarchism is a philosophy towards life, which can be applicable to almost any, you know, domain of human knowledge. And anarchists in general tend to write sort of social theory books, you know, for other anarchists. And I think what maybe is more useful is that, you know, if you're a gardener, to write anarchism for gardeners and to look at sort of the knowledge you have in gardening and look at the metaphors that inspire you to take new leaps and bounds with your philosophy of anarchism. And that's sort of what I've done with cognitive neuroscience, computational cognitive neuroscience, which is what I do. I very much think that anarchism, one of the central tenets of anarchism is attempting to integrate the various far-flung pieces of your life under capitalism into a sort of functioning whole. And this is my attempt to do that. This attempt, you know, I think it has some of the questions which are brought up in sort of the study of the mind are directly relevant to the study of political theory. And unfortunately, no, most political theorists, not going to name any names, tend to base their sort of, you know, claims about how politics should work on how the human mind works. You know, humans are inherently this or inherently that or not inherently this or not inherently that. And they usually base these claims either on, you know, sheer personal preference of ancient philosophers, sort of what they feel is right, any number of things. This really isn't the best way to go about things, I think. I think that if you're interested in finding out, sort of, if you're interested in making a radical, revolutionary political social theory, you should base it on what's known about the human mind. Because there's always going to be a connection between sort of the mental and the social, between who we are and how we understand ourselves and how we understand our interactions with others. And anarchism is a very ambitious philosophy calling for nothing but like the complete restructuring of our entire social relationships with our world and the environment, and to sort of base that on very fuzzy things, you know, it's fine if you feel in your heart, and I totally respect that, but I think at the same point, there may be other insights from other fields which are just as useful and interesting. What this really comes down to is that in modern day life, I don't know how many people here are involved with academics. Academic knowledge is very fragmented and specialized. It was not, you know, always this way. The prime example of a mental and social philosophy is actually Plato. Plato's Republic is not only a map of, you know, how society might work. Actually, it wasn't even really intended to be that. It was actually sort of intended to be how the mind might work. And he sort of metaphorically talks about reason as being embodied in philosopher kings, and then talks about, you know, every part in its place in the cave. And what you have is a coherent sort of picture of how human beings work, how human beings understand themselves and their environment, and how they would function in society, sort of. It remains somewhat vague. And this, it went through the, it's through, you know, most of philosophical history that's been how things have worked. You know, you sort of have a philosopher try to think of some political theory, and they would usually come up with sort of background in a mental theory. You know, Locke is an example. Locke had, you know, very influential political theorist, lots of influence in the Constitution, also came up with sort of, you know, the empirical viewpoint of human beings. You know, we have very simple mechanisms in our mind which take in stuff from the environment. And then based on simple associations between perceptions and sensations, that's how our minds create. It's like the blank slate. Sort of what you go through in school when the teacher just starts, you know, feeding you knowledge. It's sort of that. And then you have, you know, other people who are more rationalists, believing the human mind has some inherent order and that, you know, we can deduce that. You have Descartes, and he separated body and mind. He said you have one substance, which is mind, and another substance is body, and has a very interesting and, you know, ideas involving animal spirits and various things connecting the two. Sort of, but that informed a mental philosophy called dualism, which is very, if you look at how a science works, is very reflected in how a science works. And until, you know, and it more or less, you know, it was a unitary field until the university came about and academics became professionalized, in which case the academics of the mental, like psychology, you know, would be drastically chopped off from, say, sociology, or say, the social. And, you know, at some point, they stopped talking to each other on a large extent. You know, even within fields itself, just the field of philosophy, you have political philosophy, and you have philosophy of the mind. You're expected to be one or the other. You know, you can't be both. Or, and, you know, it's sort of in psychology, you're either in social psychology, you study sort of vague things such as, you know, human relations, or you're in cognitive psychology and you're studying the mind inside here. And this fragmentation is, well, A, like, evidently symptomatic of capitalism, but also definitely resulted in a state of understanding where we have social theorists who don't really know how the mind works, and we have mental people who are erecting theories of the mind without any consideration of how they would reflect in, you know, the social life. Cognitive neuroscience is sort of the coming together of lots of diverse fields. Those fields being mainly computer science, neuroscience, cognitive psychology, linguistics, occasionally a little bit of anthropology thrown in for the hell of it, and philosophy of the mind. Cognitive science's attempt to integrate, it notice that all these fields, you know, linguistics studies language, and language has something to do with the mind, and, you know, computers have artificial intelligence systems which are trying to figure out what the mind does, and then philosophy of the mind are thinking, you know, well, can a computer really think? And all these questions sort of are related to each other. So they say, well, we'll form a new field. We'll call it cognitive science. Cognitive science bases itself on quite a few premises. There's some understanding in between these fields. There's a lot of difficulty in between the fields, but there's definitely some understanding. The primary piece of understanding is that, you know, there is a human mind. It is, except for a few, it's a little bit of disagreement among some really older philosophers' mind, but the human mind is based out of neurons, you know, cells. These cells basically communicate with each other using electrochemical impulses, and they are arranged in networks where they talk to each other by spreading little feelers, to say, called dendrites. And through the interaction of these neurons, this wonderful thing we have called the human mind exists and functions. And it's a purely materialistic philosophy. It does not say that there's, you know, some separate matter called mind which is somehow attached through some type of, you know, tube or something to that physical mind. That we have the physical mind essentially is the mind we all know and love so much. This was mainly found through some early, there's very early evidence of this. I don't know how many people are familiar with amnesia and the symptoms of that. Ends up if you, for example, there's a famous neuropsychological patient called HM, in which case he had there's a little part of your brain called the hippocampus, sort of in the middle. If that gets damaged, you lose the ability to maintain new memories. So you have a perfect memory of who you are up to the damage, and then it kind of gets fuzzy in varying degrees depending on the damage. There's also cases of language being specialized in various parts of the brain. Language, for example, there's an area called Broca's area, which is around here. If that gets damaged, you'll lose ability to speak. Your speech will also lose sort of its grammatical quality, and you'll be able to talk, but sort of in a telegraphic manner, like, you know, lots of stuttering. I can't conjugate, you know, speak. And that gave some evidence that definitely something uniquely human had a definite home within the brain as a piece of physical matter. So then it's like, oh, well, we just have to, you know, we'll just do it. We'll just keep on damaging people's brains, and we'll eventually figure out sort of where everything is. And they started that. Didn't work too particularly well, because a lot of what was discovered was that essentially the mind is very much interconnected. While you do have, particularly, like, you know, you have a part of the brain which, you know, processes vision, you have sort of the spatial, you have linguistic, you know, you have sort of more personality, decision, judgment areas up in the front. Often when doing a simple task, multiple parts of these areas would interconnect and work together. And people also were like, well, okay, so I have all these parts of the brain, and they all sort of have their own separate function, and how do they all integrate? You know, there must be a central executive system hanging out up there, which integrates it all. This is very highly regarded. Like, you know, this decade, people have been trying to find the mysterious central executive decision which integrates everything. It hasn't been located, most likely will not be located, because the brain essentially operates in a decentralized fashion, with various sort of sections of the brain working more or less autonomously, sharing information as needed. So there isn't, you know, you don't have this super ego or the centralized executive system hanging up there, sort of sorting out all the signals, shuffling some here, shuffling some there, like a computer processor. It's more or less integrated, but integrated in a decentralized fashion. This, of course, starts sounding a little bit like anarchism. There's some philosophical ramifications of having a philosophy which is based not in any sort of abstract concept of the universal world spirit descending upon humanity, but in a more sort of like, well, you know, we have this matter, this hunk of flesh, it's the mind, it's philosophy in the flesh. That if we are creatures of flesh and the mind is simply material, the question starts sort of idealism. Kind of gets chunked out the window with dualism. So instead of having, you know, if you have a separate world that's just pure mind, then it's easy to imagine things existing up there, like, you know, the perfect consensus meeting or the perfect ideology. Those all more or less have to be thrown out the window. All ideals such as, you know, nonviolence, whatnot, exist in the mind and has their existence basically formulated through and created by the existence of the person who believes in them. And so you can't expect sort of both postmodern subjectivity, sort of like, oh, I create anything in my mind, doesn't really stand up, because the mind is revealed to be a piece of flesh which sort of gets inputs, processes them, gets outputs, and the processing of the inputs is dependent upon the structure of the mind. So you can't have sort of a free-for-all going on. On the same point, sort of rigid objectivism, sort of like, well, there's this reality out there, and I see it, and you see it, and it has to be the same thing, isn't entirely true either. It's shown that, you know, while the mind processes reality, it's sort of a feedback. So, you know, I go and I do one thing. I perhaps, you know, drink some water, and then, you know, I'm not thirsty anymore. That has a feedback connection that's actually physically embodied in the neurons, so that you have sort of the structure of the mind emerging from your environment, and thus any new input coming into the mind is shaped by the input combined with the pre-existent genetic structure already there. So you don't have any particular sort of hard, cold, objective reality, idealistic or realistic out there or not. We have to start recognizing in a sort of, I think, humble fashion, that we are all products of all the same species. And we all do definitely have the same mind on some level, but we also have to realize the impact of the environment upon that. And that sort of hoping for strange ideals won't really work out in the end, because we come from different places. It's sort of common sense, but being ratified by a cognitive neuroscience, there's also sort of the question of, there's been a lot of talk about rationalism and reason and anarcho-primitivism and whatnot in anarchist circles nowadays. Essentially, and this bears directly upon what cognitive science does, and this sort of anarcho-primitivism is basically the ideology that primitive life good, modern life bad. It finds its perhaps one of its finest expressions in the writings of John Zerzan and his belief that language and numbers and technology all essentially are inhuman, reified concepts which enslave humanity. You know, he says, you know, if you believe in language, if you think language is a good thing, and all your thoughts are formed by language, which is actually, you know, a not very well respected doctrine in linguistics, then language is ideological by itself. You know, the second you start using language, you've started collapsing your real life experiences. So what we need to do is we need to figure out some way to get back to a world in which we don't have language. And this really, this sort of linguistic determinism is not very well accepted anymore, outside perhaps some strange anthropology circles. Cognitive Science, I really would highly recommend this book for anyone's interested. It's The Language Instinct by Steven Pinker. He actually has a newer and better one called Words and Rules, which language is basically, Steven says, is an instinct. It's something which is basically genetically part of our heritage through evolution. It's really quite hard to reject unless you're in an environment in which there isn't any language at all. So for example, you know, you often have trading communities develop. You have a community of, you know, perhaps Chinese people having to communicate with English speakers, and they have to speak the same language, but they don't really know each other's languages, so they sort of make a pigeon tongue out of it. Tongue which uses a bit of English, a bit of Chinese, no real grammar. And, you know, this will go on, and they'll have children, and children will grow up in an environment in which primarily a pigeon language is spoken. And a linguist called Bickerson discovered that children who are brought up in a pigeon language environment, without actually hearing grammar, will start using grammar in the pigeon language and creating a full-fledged language out of the pigeon language called a creole. And the same phenomenon can actually be, you know, a lot of people who learn American Sign Language later in their lives, deaf people, you know, don't use it very well. But their children who are brought up in an environment in which American Sign Language is just barely used badly, will develop a very grammatical form of American Sign Language, or whatever sign language is being used in the country they're in. So this gives some evidence that the complexity of language and grammar is based in the mind and not based in the environment, which would contradict sort of what a lot of the anarcho-primitivist theorists want, which is, well, you know, language is this thing in the environment, which leads to reification and ideologies and capitalism and is thus evil, so we should abandon it. It's not that simple. Language may lead to certain thought patterns, but generally, you know, it's a human instinct. There's also sort of, you know, a lot of the assaults against language are based on feelings that, for example, Chomsky, you know, besides being the wonderful political theorist he is, or I don't know, he just writes amazing books on current political issues all the time, has various grammatical theories. And these grammatical theories are really boring and dry and mathematical, and no one wants to read them. And that's because they're boring and dry and mathematical, have to be somehow related to capitalism and evil industrial civilization. And what's actually a lot of cognitive scientists are now finding out that the basis of language is more metaphorical, more poetic. This is, sorry to constantly recommend books. They're not mine. I think Raymond Gibbs has done a good amount of work in attempting to display how the essential language we use is metaphorical. So, for example, when I'm having an argument with someone, I interpret that argument as a form of warfare. I take a stance. I defend my position. You know, I have shaky foundations of my argument. And that often this type of metaphorical use of language is so expressive that it's can be considered poetic, and that essentially almost every human being on some level is a poet because language is inherently metaphorical. And this sort of contradicts the language is this dry, horrible, rational thing viewpoint of some anarcho-primitivist. Then we also have the question of mathematics. You know, there's one thing that embodies pure human reason that is above and beyond the human mind. It's the discipline of mathematics. But recently there's been a lot of work showing that it's not really the case, that mathematics, if anything, has a very human face. Mathematics, as usual, Zerzan would decry mathematics as the beginning of hierarchy, you know, people taking down bills, numbers, seeing who's paid who taxes, which it definitely is used for since the dawn of civilization. But also, if you look at sort of the cognitive evidence as where numbers come from, numbers are definitely part of, like, language. It's a human instinct. Human babies as young as four days old can distinguish between basic numbers. For example, is a lot of cognitive scientists attempting to discover very ingenious ways of proving a simple point. So they would put a baby, and they put a screen in front of it, and they put, you know, perhaps some type of small figure, Jabba the Hutt, I believe, in front of the screen. And they'd be like, oh, look at that. And the baby will stare at it. And then, you know, they'll put another one behind the screen without having the baby see it put behind the screen. And they would lift the screen up, and the baby would be very confused. Or they would put one obviously in front of the screen, so the baby would see one of the figures being placed in front of the screen, and another one would be removed from behind the screen. And the baby you'd open up, and the baby would be confused. The same phenomenon has actually been observed in rhesus monkeys. Using sort of similar techniques, babies, it's more or less they can, you know, after a few months, they start doing addition up to like 4 and 5, you know, numbers like 4 and 5. And using sort of neuroimaging techniques in which they sort of, you know, they can shoot little weird electrical and magnetic pulses at your brain and figure out which parts of your brain are sort of active doing what process, that numbers are actually not sort of in their own unique place, but are in the sort of generalized area where sort of any spatial processing is. So, for example, you know, when you're cutting something like carpentry, you're using, you know, geometry to some extent, and that you sort of, numbers essentially are just a metaphorical extraction from basic spatial and geometric processes. So, sort of an attack against numbers is probably wrong. And then there's computers. You know. Computers will be intelligent. That's a claim thrown around quite a lot. Probably not so. Computers are remarkably really bad at modeling the complexity of the human mind. The human mind is quite adept at, because it's decentralized processing. So you have each little group of neurons doing its own thing and then sharing information only more or less as needed. There's also a lot of redundancy in the human mind. So if one part, you know, breaks or doesn't work particularly well, you have another part there to take its place. Computers, you know, generally don't work like that. There's a centralized processor. There's a separate memory system, various separate subsystems. It operates on everything by converting it to basically, you know, arithmetic operations, you know, plussing and adding and zeros and ones. Human mind doesn't work like that at all. Human mind works in more, if anything, associative and fluid process, which if you try to, I do computer simulations of neurons, and they send computers crashing quite often because the complexity boggles a computer. Yet these sort of slow but many, many decentralized units of the human mind can handle such complexity really easily. So I think the whole what I'm trying to aim at here is that there's definite ramifications. If you're going to try to base a political philosophy on human nature, you know, and make such vast claims such as numbers are bad, language is bad, or even, you know, well, humans naturally need some type of hierarchy, or you really should try to look at maybe some of the scientific evidence. Look at various different fields outside of political theory and sociology. See what they have to say. They may directly contradict what you want. And also I think that there's, you know, surprisingly enough, there's often interconnections between how we implement our radical philosophy and how some science feels the human mind works. For example, there's a field called reinforcement learning, where basically learning is dependent upon very, very, very basic human necessities such as, you know, food, water, sex. If you reward, animals, if they do a random action, you know, they're hanging out and in a cage and there's a lever and they kind of randomly walk around and hit the lever and food comes out, their mind, when they eat the food, gets flushed by dopamine, which is a chemical which increases the propensity of that particular group of neurons to fire again. So if they were, you know, somehow hitting that lever on purpose, the propensity of that would be increased. It's an old psychological doctrine, it's behaviorism. But it still has some relevance, because what do we see in today's society but money being the universal reward for almost any action? That all your basic human needs, you know, not love, but food, you know, water, very simple survival needs, are connected to money. So how can we expect people to embrace a radical philosophy when whenever they do anything for money, it gets more or less instantly rewarded? You know, you get your burger at McDonald's. But if you do something for anarchism, you know, what do you get? Maybe your comradeship of your peers. Which is why I believe that sort of undermining the reinforcement learning system in place placed by capitalism on money, and instead saying, you know, we're anarchists, here's, you know, free food. You know, we're going to give you stuff for free. We're going to try to show you how much more dependent and reliable autonomous living can be. And providing concrete necessities for human beings is probably a good way to commence political activity. So, I mean, that's basically sort of just a very broad and brief introduction to cognitive neuroscience and some of the interactions it may have between political philosophy. And I basically think that as far as metaphors for society go, the human mind's a pretty good one. You know, autonomous neurons interacting with each other, doing amazingly complex things. I think if society was more structured along those terms, we would definitely live in a world that's worthy of ourselves and our magnificent natural heritage. So that's really all.